you want to do the intro?
I do not want to do the intro. We should put that in.
We could put that in.
Yeah, let's do it.
But us talking about putting it in, I might have to cut that out.
Why?
Nah, that's all right. We'll work it out. Anyway. What the... Hello and welcome to What the History.
Hello!
Your bite-sized taste of tasty morsels of history that won't spoil your history appetite.
It's like a Milky Way. It won't spoil your dinner, apparently. I've never tried that. No.
No. Anyway, I'm Trevor Holland.
And I'm Susie Holland.
And we're here to share some little bizarre bits of history with you. So yep, this fortnight, Susie, what do you have for us?
Okay, I've got quite an interesting little tale that gripped Australia in the 19th century. So it's yet another Australian What the History. That's two in a row from me. Yay! Yay, go Aussie! Obviously, I'm starting off this week, so... Okay, my story's on the Tichborne Claimant. Okay, now, there have been really a lot of interesting tales of fraud in history and people pretending to be someone else to achieve status, money and power, and keeping up the charade until the end of their lives or when they decide that they can't live the lie any longer and come clean about their deception. Now, one such proven fraudulent story was the case of the Tichborne Claimant, which took place in the 19th century and began with the birth of Roger Charles Tichborne on the 5th of January 1829 in Paris. Now, Roger was in line to be the 11th baronet after his father Sir James Tichborne, and therefore stood not only to gain the title, but a hell of a lot of estates and fortune, including the family estate Tichborne Park in Hampshire in England, which was this massive, massive, massive house with massive, gorgeous gardens, etc., as you'd probably find back then. Now, the marriage between Roger's mum and dad weren't very happy, so mum and dad split up, and mum Henriette took Roger to Paris to live, while James looked after the estates, etc. Therefore, French was his mother tongue, and though he spoke English... barely, it was heavily accented. Now, I hope that you're paying attention because this plays a part in the future, and there will be a test on this afterwards. Ha, only kidding. Okay. James decided later on that Roger should come to England to finish his education, and Henriette was not impressed. But anyway, Dad won, and in 1848, Roger finished his education and followed this up in 1849 with sitting with the exams for and being admitted to the 6th Royal Dragoon Guards. And he spent the next 3 years there, mainly in Ireland. And now, while visiting his uncle Edward, the current holder of the baronetcy, Roger fell in love with his first cousin, Catherine. Aww, yeah, it's a bit weird. Anyway, but was forbidden to go any further with her due to their close family connection, as you'd probably expect. But they met on the sly anyway. Now, Roger was very upset with the whole affair, not being able to see his love. So he set sail for South America in 1853 after the Dragoons told him that, hey, you're in the Britain for a while. And so he couldn't handle that, so off he went to South America. Now, in June 1853, he found out that his father James had succeeded to the baronetcy and had decided to sail around various places in South America. And Roger went to Jamaica in 1854 and he boarded a ship called the Bella. The boat capsized off the Brazilian coast and was found with no one on board. So everyone assumed that everyone had drowned, and the Tichborne family was advised that Roger was lost at sea, and mother was very, very, very upset. But rumors began to circulate that another ship picked up survivors and took them to Australia. So when he couldn't be found, ads asking about Roger's whereabouts started appearing in newspapers around Australia with a large reward for information attached. And I quote, these gave details of the Bella's last voyage and described Roger Tichborne as of a delicate constitution, rather tall, with very light brown hair and blue eyes. Now, that'll play a part in the future as well, so I hope you're paying attention. A most liberal reward would be given for any information that may definitely point out his fate. Okay, and now in November 1865, a lawyer by the name of William Gibbs sent Lady Tichborne, Roger's mum, a letter saying that a man called him to say that he was the missing heir and was calling himself Thomas Castro. Now, he was Thomas was working in Wagga Wagga in New South Wales as a butcher and was much heavier build than Roger, had lighter hair and spoke no French whatsoever. But Lady Tichborne, who was bereft that her son was missing and might have found him after 10 years, accepted Thomas without a doubt and sent for him. The poor woman. Thomas landed in London in 1866 and convinced the family lawyer, Edward Hopkins, and Sir Thomas's servant, Andrew Bogle, or Bogle, that he was indeed Roger Tichborne. After convincing these two, Thomas Castro then set off to France, to Paris, to be presented to Lady Tichborne, who of course accepted him with open arms. But other family members weren't so sure of this, saying the racehorse has turned into a cart horse. Now Thomas was sitting pretty, and from where he was now situated, he could research his new family and amass large debts, which Lady Tichborne, happy as hell that her son had seemingly returned from the grave, happily paid. Yeah, so obviously the other family members are sceptical and hired an agent in Australia and found that Thomas Castro was in fact a guy called Arthur Orton, who was originally from London, no less, and had jumped ship in Chile and made his way to Australia. So the experiences that he had in South America, he fabricated into how Roger came to Australia. And Thomas Castro didn't exist. And Arthur got upset when he couldn't identify key family members, and he accused the family of trying to catch him out with imposters. And Arthur even contacted his family in Wapping, in London, when he got there to say hi. That's pretty stupid. But anyway, Lady Tichborne died in 1868, and Arthur even demanded to be one of the pallbearers, and needed to keep up the pretense or else he would have no income. Now, he actually ended up having quite a few supporters in all this, and so they set up a fund and a house for him, but he was after the whole Tichborne estate, the whole kit and caboodle. So then the Tichborne family finally had enough of this guy, and they took him to court, and this started off one of the biggest court cases of the 19th century. Now, Arthur is now known as the claimant in all legal proceedings. Now, the first case began on the 11th of May 1871 and went until the 8th of March 1872 and was known as the Tichborne versus Lushington trial. Now, this first trial was to establish if the claimant had any right to the estate. Now, nearly 100 people spoke in his defence for some reason, but the claimant's not being able to speak French and not having any tattoos, which Roger possessed, and holes in his defence began the next trial, which started in 1873 and ran for 6 months. There's a photo of Roger Tichborne taken before he left Chile, I think it was, and a photo of Arthur Orton, and had the two morphing into each other to see if there was any sort of resemblance that can be picked up. But this photographic evidence was not given weight in the courts because they believed that such images could be manipulated. This trial was, the second trial here, was called Regina versus Castro, so basically the Queen and Council versus Castro, with the jury needing to decide if the claimant was really Roger Tichborne. And this also failed, and the claimant was done for perjury in February 1874 and received the sentence of 14 years hard labour for his efforts. Now, when I was doing research for this particular episode, I came across some old broadsheets and satire written about this case, and some of it's quite funny. There was a one written to the tune of Yankee Doodle, I thought was funny anyway. And I found out the claimant had stacks of supporters who wanted to see him out of jail, and while he was in there, he made several public appeals that he was indeed Roger Tichborne. And he got out after 10 years of his 14-year sentence. He went to the USA to garner attention. He actually ended up coming back to Australia and dying on the 1st of April 1898 of heart disease. Now, this is an interesting end to this. So because of the trial and information and all fun stuff that had garnered, it was a massive turnout to his funeral. So some 5,000 people turned up to see it, and the Tichborne family actually allowed a card to be placed on top of the coffin before it was interred, with the following written on it: Sir Roger Charles Dorothy Tichborne and the cemetery records list Tichborne. And I find it really weird how after all this time that the family actually sort of like gave in. They called it an act of generosity, but it was just weird. I mean, they took him to court and he was found out to be not Roger Tichborne. And on this note, I would like to say, what the history?
Very cool. Probably not one of the first cases of identity fraud, I suppose.
No, but certainly, definitely not.
Certainly one that seemed to go a lot further than it made sense to have gone. But anyway.
Yeah, I think they were just a bit starved for attention and good fun stuff in 19th century Sydney and London. Everywhere else.
Quite possibly. So, from mistaken identity or assumed identity, we shall go to potatoes.
Trust me, it is more interesting than it sounds.
What I've done here is basically I'm talking about Antoine Augustin Parmentier, the saviour of the spud.
Yay!
So there are things that we take for granted, stuff that we think has always been a part of life. But in some cases, it took someone with a bit of vision to make something common in the first place. In this instance, French pharmacist Antoine Augustin Parmentier can be hailed as a hero every time you sit down to a tasty potato dish. Now, there's quite a bit of French place names and stuff in this, so I will say straight up, excuse my pronunciation.
Trevor doesn't speak French at all.
No. Born in 1737... Parmentier lived in France at a time when the potato was only considered suitable as pig food. They believed spuds were unhealthy for humans, even poisonous, to the point where French Parliament banned the cultivation of the vegetable in 1748, when they believed it caused leprosy, of all things.
What the?
Yes, indeed.
Sorry.
So, when he turned 18, Parmentier was apprenticed to an apothecary in Paris, but soon decided to enlist in Louis XV's army to fight against Prussia during the Seven Years' War, from 1756 to 1763.
To those playing at home.
Yes. During this war, he was captured 5 times, and as a prisoner of war, he was basically fed potatoes by his captors. Now, despite being captured so many times and being forced to eat this leprosy-inducing vegetable, he returned to Paris after the war and resumed his apprenticeship, completing his pharmaceutical training and gaining the post of the apothecary at Le Hôtel des Invalides, a hospital and care home for retired soldiers. Don't judge me.
I'm not judging okay. at all. No, 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 no. Please, play on.
I will. Now, in 1769, France's wheat crop failed, causing panic, and a national competition was announced to encourage study into, and I quote, food substances capable of reducing the calamities of famine, end quote. Parmentier stepped up and won the gold medal for a paper on the chemical analysis of, you guessed it, the potato.
Yay!
As a result of Parmentier's efforts, the Paris Faculty of Medicine lifted the ban on cultivation of potatoes in 1772. Despite this official endorsement, there was still much resistance to the consumption of the spud, particularly from the religious community that owned the land at Le Hôtel des Invalides, who refused to allow him to grow the vegetable. Parmentier did not let that get him down, though. He kept pushing for the potato to be more than an emergency backup food. He even got King Louis XVI and his queen, Marie Antoinette, on board with gifts of potato blossoms, which King Louis even used as an adornment on his jacket. Now, the king and queen allowed him to host extravagant dinner parties for Parisian high society and foreign dignitaries, including Benjamin Franklin, where every course featured a potato dish. Unfortunately, there's no information on what potato-inspired dish was provided for dessert. While it's all well and good to have the king and queen on board and the court happy with your dishes, to ensure the potato was viable as an alternative food source, Parmentier had to ensure the common people, particularly the farmers, would be willing to cultivate this once banned food. What he did, in my opinion, was pure genius and is what brought him to my attention as a What the History moment. So the king granted him a plot of land at Sablons. Parmentier planted a crop of potatoes and recruited armed guards, to give the illusion the plants were very valuable. The guards had some very specific orders. They were encouraged to accept any bribes from the general populace who wanted to take some of the crop, and would deliberately leave the land unguarded at night so others could sneak in to steal the plants that Parmentier wanted them to cultivate anyway.
Yay!
Acceptance of the potato really started to gain traction in 1785, when bad harvests caused a risk of famine in the north of the country. Famine was prevented, though, by the potato, with Parmentier himself manning potato soup kitchens to help feed the hungry during the crisis. When the French Revolution hit in 1789, and despite it being favoured by the King and Queen, the potato was declared by the Paris Commune as revolutionary food, essentially making it compulsory to be eaten. In fact, when the Commune was besieged in 1795, potatoes were being grown in such number and in so many locations, they were able to stave off being starved out during the siege. Once the French Revolution was over, and Napoleon became ruler of France, Parmentier's influence and the impact of his work meant that Napoleon enlisted him as the Inspector General of the Health Service. And from there, he actually went on to introduce the first mandatory smallpox vaccination campaign.
I absolutely love this guy.
So he's not all about potatoes, just mostly. Parmentier died in 1813, but he has been remembered. He's been commemorated on stamps, he had streets, restaurants, and even a metro station named after him in Paris. And if you visit his grave at Père Lachaise Cemetery, you will likely see potatoes left on the edges of his tomb. Mm. There even exists a way to bring him into your own home. Well, kind of. What you will need is 800 grams of potatoes, salt for parboiling the potatoes, 2 cloves of lightly crushed garlic, 3 separate tablespoons of melted butter, 2 tablespoons of chopped parsley, 2 tablespoons of chopped coriander, 2 tablespoons of chopped mint, 1/2 teaspoon of lemon zest, a squeeze of lemon juice, coarse salt, and freshly ground black pepper, and that last 3 are to your personal taste. Preheat an oven to 200 degrees Celsius, scrub the potatoes but don't peel them, chop them into approximately 1 centimeter cubes, then rinse them in cold water. Put the potatoes in a saucepan with 2 1/4 cups of water, 1 1/2 teaspoons of salt, and the garlic cloves. Bring to a boil over a medium-high heat, then lower the heat and let them simmer for 2 minutes. Drain them, remove the garlic, and return the potatoes to the saucepan. Then let them sit off the heat, covered by a tea towel, for about 5 minutes to let them dry out. Toss the potato cubes in 2 tablespoons of butter, then spread the cubes in a single layer onto baking trays. Roast them in the oven for 30 minutes or until golden and crispy. Give the trays a shake about halfway through. Once the potatoes are cooked, mix the parsley, coriander, and mint with the remaining butter and the lemon zest and toss the potatoes with the mixture. Add the coarse salt, the black pepper, and lemon juice to your preferred taste, and then serve. And I will include this recipe in the podcast description. Enjoy your potatoes Parmentier and your little taste of what the history.
I love this man so much. He's brilliant.
I just knew about the field and the guards, and the more I dug into him, it's like his entire life is like, what the history, and yeah.
I think he's a great ambassador for France, and
potatoes.
Yeah, love him. Oh, you know, potatoes are my favourite vegetable. Love them. Well, I'm Scots-Irish, what do you expect?
Very.
It's like, yeah. So, yeah, this guy rocks, in my opinion.
Stop hitting the desk.
Sorry, I will stop hitting the desk. I just get excited.
I know. And let me hope you get excited too, out there. Ha ha, segue.
I see what you've done there.
Yes. And, you know, if you have any thoughts or comments on what you've heard tonight, we would love to hear from you. You can head to our homepage, wthpod.rufusproject.com, and you can leave a comment below this episode. You can find the What the History podcast Facebook page nice and easily, or you can send us an email to wthpod@rufusproject.com. If you're listening through there through a podcast player or iTunes, you can even leave us a review and a rating on a podcast service, because we would love as many people as possible to find out about this podcast.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. It's little, it's cute, it's full of interesting tidbits and things that you never even knew about. and probably maybe not want to hear about again. But, hey, we welcome everyone.
Absolutely. So hopefully you'll be back next time and a few more people will be back with you for another taste of What the History.
Tell your friends. Even tell your enemies if you want to. Hey, bring it on.
Tell everybody.
Tell everyone. Bye.